Okay, can people hear me? No. I'm gonna have to, if I speak right, I see, okay. You know what, I might actually do this. I've always wanted to do this. Is this okay?
Yes.
All right, handicap with one hand. Okay, good evening. Welcome to Three Talmudic Heroines. My name is Gila. Has everybody got a source sheet? You've all got source sheets up here. Anybody who hasn't got is welcome to please come and take. Be rather hard to follow if you don't have one, so do please help yourselves. Only one left. Okay, at this point, from this point on, I'm going to ask you all to be very generous and share with your friends and neighbors. That's it, pass them around. You have to share, I'm sorry. Okay, so I'd like to begin. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yes, let's have a poll. Thank you very much. It's all right. I'm going to move around anyhow. This is constraining. So I'd like to begin with something of a personal confession. I apologize to those of you who might have heard this once before. I first started teaching Agadah, or Talmudic narrative, a few years ago. I started giving a small weekly women's shiur. And about a year after doing that, I got invited to start speaking in larger and more co-ed settings. And when I did, I took all of the stories of the women of the Talmud, I put them deep into a drawer, or rather a cupboard, and I left them there. For two reasons. For one thing, I didn't want to be the token woman doing the token women text, because everybody does that. And for another thing, many of these stories are quite sexual in nature, and that was just very far out of my comfort zone. And after doing this for a few years, you can hear me, yes? Could be a little louder. Sorry? Very close. All right. I'm going to get my lipstick all over it. Eating the mic. After doing this for a few years, I discovered, much to my own frustration, that I was depriving myself of the pleasure of teaching some of the most fascinating, most complex stories in all of the Talmud. And so when Pardes invited me to give this series, I thought, okay, Pardes is a safe space. I'm going to teach the women's texts. I've only ever done this once before. I'm a bit nervous, and I'd like to ask for your help on two counts. One is when we do at some point arrive at stories that have some sort of sexual aspect to them, I'd like for us to make an effort to keep it clean. This might sometimes be difficult. The Talmud does not always keep it clean, but I'd like for us to try. And two, I'd like for us to make a definite effort to avoid the F word. F being feminism. Not because feminism in the Talmud is not hugely important, it is. But because far more than the politics of these stories, I'm actually interested in the ethics of these stories. When the Talmud, it will be my claim that when the Talmud tells a story of a woman, 9 times out of 10, it tells a story of an other, with a capital O. And it's through these stories that the Talmud works out the problematics of otherness. It's this ethical dimension which I'd like to ultimately get at. Okay, so Talmudic heroines. Women in the Talmud are notoriously anonymous. When they appear, they are more often than not nameless. They are named after the significant men in their lives. So the Talmud is riddled with wives of, mothers of, daughters of, and sisters of. We very seldom have a woman who appears under her own name. So much so that we actually know very little about the female nomenclature of the time. We just don't know what women in the time of the Talmud were called. Tali Lan, an important Talmudist historian who actually counted, says that there are 52 named women in the entire rabbinic corpus, as opposed to over 1,000 named men. Now turn your source sheets upside down. Turn them around. No peeking. And without looking too closely, those who looked can't play. Without looking too closely, I'd like to ask you, who are the named women of the Talmud? Now, the rules are they have to be in the Talmud, but they also have to be of the Talmud. So, no, doesn't count if the Talmud is speaking about a biblical character or a historical personage. Those don't count. There's got to be women who are in the Talmud and part of the rabbinic world. Yes. Bulya. All right. Very good. So Bulya is the first answer given to this question always, and rightfully so. She's probably the most famous of Talmudic heroines. She's become something of a poster woman for female study of Talmud, for other causes. She is the most well-known, and we will not be looking at her story. For one thing, it's been done to death, no pun intended, and more importantly, the main narrative studied with regards to Bulya is the one where her husband sends a disciple to seduce her and then she commits suicide. That, and this may come as a surprise, is not actually in the Talmud. That's not a Talmudic story at all. What we do have in the Talmud is the obscure, ominous phrase Ma'aseh Bulya, the act of Bulya, and that gives rise to a later post-Talmudic tradition, which Rashi later on brings in his commentary to that phrase Ma'aseh Bulya. So we will not be doing her story. Who else? Rachel, second answer given to this question, and it's wrong. That is right. She is the wife of Rabbi Akiva, or the daughter of Kalba Savoy. She is never once called Rachel in the Talmud. Ah. The first time she is designated as Rachel is in a much later, again, post-Talmudic work called the Avot de Rabbi Natan. So we will not be looking at the story of Rachel. Who else? Yes. Shlomtzion is good, although I'm going to classify her as a historical character rather than a rabbinic character, although there is some overlap. So we will not be looking at her story. Who else? Yalta, right? Were you peeking? No. All right. Yalta, very good. Yalta is the great shrew of the Talmud, and we will be looking at her story tonight. Who else? Anyone? Anyone at all? Okay, so just to throw out a few others at you, we have Ima Shalom. Ima Shalom is the heroine of a very tragic epilogue of the Avon of Achnai. Right? The Avon of Achnai, Lo B'Shamayim Hi, Nitzchuni Banai. There's an epilogue in which Rabbi Eliezer, who was that one sage causing trouble, is put in cherem. And Ima Shalom is this tragic character caught between the two men of her life, between her husband Rabbi Eliezer, who's been put in cherem, and her brother Rabban Gamliel, who instigates the cherem. Very interesting, very sad story. We won't be looking at it because this too has been done to death. And again, no pun intended. Anyone else you can think of? All right, so some of the women we will be looking at. Yalta, we will be looking at tonight. Another woman is Choma. Choma is the great femme fatale of the Talmud, and we'll be looking at her story next week. A third woman is Marta, Marta bat Baitos. She's the prima donna of the Talmud, and we'll probably look at her story 3 weeks from now. Another woman is Cheruta. She is the Madonna whore. We probably won't be looking at her story because I've done that once before in Jerusalem. And then there's a handful of other women. We have Chova, we have Donag, we have Lichluchit, we have Kimchit. Most of them appear in very short nuggets, not real stories. So these are the women we will be looking at over the next 3 weeks. Now, you'll notice that I've introduced every one of these women with an epithet. A feminine, or rather an anti-feminine stereotype. The shrew, the prima donna, the femme fatale, the Madonna whore. And my overarching claim for the series is this. Blanking out. Every one of the stories we are going to look at seems, at face value, to be misogynistic, to be a critical or sometimes even derisive portrayal of a bad woman. In almost every one of these stories, we will discover, upon second and third reading, that this is not at all the case. That the story is actually far more complex that a close, careful reading will reveal there is a lot more to the narrative and to its heroine than initially meets the eye. Okay? Now, in trying to redeem the heroines of the Talmud, there's a great deal, I think, that we can learn about A, how to read a text, and B, how to regard an other. Reading is fundamentally an ethical act. And in learning how to treat the characters of a text, we will, I hope, learn how to treat the characters of our lives. Now, this attempt of rereading a text from a redemptive point of view was called by 20th century poet Adrian Rich revisioning, and this is number 2 on your source sheet. Revision, the act of looking back, of seeing with fresh eyes, of entering an old text from a new critical direction, is for us more than a chapter in cultural history. It is an act of survival. So what I'd like to do with you over the next 3 weeks is to try and revision the stories of the women of the Talmud. And we have much to do, so let's get started straight away with the great shrew of the Talmud, Yalta. Now, what is a shrew? That was not a rhetorical question. What is a shrew? Still not a rhetorical question. Does nobody know what a shrew is? Argumentative. Small animal, good. Yes? Demanding. What else? Sorry? Nagging. Shrill. No, you're being far too much of a feminist, and I asked for no feminism. All right, so a fun and little known fact is that a shrew is actually a small mole-like mammal known for its aggressive nature and its venomous bite. Indeed. Throughout the years, the term expanded to include the kind of woman just described, that nagging, annoying, ill-tempered, disobedient, aggressive woman who attacks the people around her, namely men, both verbally and physically, either verbally or physically, and sometimes both. The shrew is a basic female archetype, a stock character. Sorry, I had some water. Ah, there it is. Thank you very much. She's a basic female stock character, and we find her littered throughout Western literature and culture. I'd like for us to think... Thank you so much. I'd like for us to think about some of the shrews we know. And hold on one moment. Let us begin with the Bible. There's one classic case of a shrew in the Bible. Anybody think who it might be? Who? Jezebel is interesting. I would say Jezebel is a lot more of a femme fatale, and we'll actually be looking at her next week when we discuss the femme fatale. Michal is actually interesting and not incorrect. That's a good point. I was not thinking of Michal, actually. I was thinking about somebody to do with a holiday coming up. Vashti. Very good. Vashti, who disobeys her husband's orders to attend the royal banquet. You had a question? So that's interesting.
So maybe a learned woman is able to break the gender stereotypes and be very strong and aggressive and fearful in a way that's considered to be more masculine. And an average woman who wasn't part of this world of her learning can never be allowed to...
So that's an interesting point. You certainly are right with regards to Yalta, however... Some of the examples we're about to look at show very average, very not rich, not important women who were also shrews. So that's not true across the board. It is actually completely true of the woman we're going to study tonight. Okay, shrews in the Talmud. There are many, many shrews in the Talmud. Can anybody think of an example? Yes?
There's a woman who broke like all the wine with her husband.
That's the story we're doing tonight. You know everything, don't you? Okay, so there are actually shrews all over the Talmud. However, we have a cluster of such stories. Often, stories on a particular theme will appear in groups throughout the Talmud, and we have a group, a cluster of shrew tales in Tractate Yevamot. It's number 3 on your source sheet, and can I ask somebody to read, please? Thank you.
Rab was constantly tormented by his wife. If he told her, prepare me lentils, she would prepare him small peas. And if he asked for small peas, she prepared him lentils. When his son Haya grew up, he gave her his father's instruction in the reverse order. Your mother, Rab once remarked to him, has improved. It was I, the other replied, who reversed your orders to her. Rab Haya was constantly tormented by his wife. He, nevertheless, whenever he obtained anything suitable, wrapped it up in his scarf and brought it to her. Said Rab to him, but surely she is tormenting the master. It is sufficient for us, the other replied, if they rear up our children and deliver us from sin. Rab Judah was reading with his son, Rab Isaac, the scriptural text, and I find more bitter than death the woman. When the latter asked him who, for instance, your mother.
One of the first ever Yo Mama jokes right here in the Talmud. So, 3 tales of a shrew. Who don't we find in any of these stories? Who is conspicuously absent? Who? The woman, the shrew. 3 stories of a shrew, not one shrew anywhere. All we have is the perspective of the poor, tormented husband who is suffering patiently through the antics of his shrewish wife. It would be very interesting to look at a tale of a shrew from the point of view of a shrew. And that is a story of Yalta that I'd like to do with you tonight. But I would like to point out that Rav Chia here makes an interesting argument. He says, as the role of women is so entirely different to the role of us men, our expectations should be similarly different. Moving further down history, classical culture. Anybody think of any shrews in classical culture? No. Before. Think Greek, Rome. Sorry? Medea. Perfect. Medea, the witch who kills her own children to punish her husband. She's a classic example of a shrew. Anyone else? Very good. Socrates was fabled. That is actually libel. We have no evidence of that anywhere, but it is the tradition that Socrates was married to a shrew. We also have the Furies, the Greco-Roman goddesses of vengeance, who were also quite shrewish in temperament. And moving slightly down to early modern literature, William Congreve in The Mourning Bride, this is number 4, coins the motto for shrews everywhere, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned." And of course, the one you were all thinking about, Katharina from Shakespeare's eponymous, The Taming of the Shrew. That's number 5 on your source sheet. But if I be waspish, best beware my sting. The picture is from the last production of Taming of the Shrew in the Globe, I think. And we can go on 19th century literature. Those of you who know one of the opening scenes of Great Expectations, where Mrs. Jo, who is actually a poor woman, uses her brother to hit her husband. We have many of them. Now, you'll notice that the majority of narratives we've looked at are comedies. Shrews often come to us within comedic settings. There's something funny about a woman who curses and scratches and bites. It's interesting to ask why, but we won't go into that for the moment. However, the shrew I'd like to focus on comes to us in a tragic rather than comic setting. Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. Now, if anybody here has not read Jane Eyre and intends to read Jane Eyre, and I highly recommend it, I'm going to pause. I'm really serious. I'm going to pause and let you exit the room for the next 3 minutes because I'm about to spoil the novel and I really don't want to do that for any of you. Seriously? Really will not be offended. You've all read it. You're so learned. Wow. Okay. So The underlying secret of Jane Eyre is that Mr. Rochester, Jane's love interest, is actually already married, and that his wife, Bertha Mason, is a mad woman locked away in the household attic. Now, this is the shrew taken to a murderous extreme, as Bertha tries repeatedly to kill her husband and succeeds ultimately in burning the house down and blinding him. Look at number 6. And would you mind reading on, as you did such a good job? Thank you.
In the deep shade at the farther end of the room, a figure ran backwards and forward. What it was, whether beast or human being, one could not at first sight tell. It groveled seemingly on all fours. It snatched and growled like some strange wild animal. But it was covered with clothing and a quantity of dark grizzled hair. Wild as a mane, hid its head and face. Mr. Rochester flung me behind him. The lunatic sprang and grappled his throat viciously and laid her teeth to his cheek. They struggled. She was a big woman, in stature almost equaling her husband, and corpulent besides. She showed virile force in the contest. More than once, she almost groveled him.
Thank you. So with these shrews in mind, I'd like to now turn to our shrew, Yalta. A few words of background. Yalta, probably from the Aramaic word for gazelle, is mentioned 7 times in the Babylonian Talmud, making her the most named woman in all of the Bavli. What is interesting is that she doesn't only come to us as part of the narratives of the stories of the Talmud, she's actually mentioned in the legal and the halachic sections too. Talmudic historians tell us that she was the daughter of the Resh Galuta, the exilarch, essentially the chief rabbi of Babylon, which corresponds nicely to your point about shrews being important women, and was probably married to Rav Nachman, one of the greatest sages of his time and head of the Nehardea yeshiva. Why probably? Because she's never actually called his wife, although she does appear with him in domestic settings. So historians conclude that she was probably married to Rav Nachman. Her story is in number 1. This is our primary text, Brachot Nun Aleph Amud Bet. And what I'd like to do tonight and over the next 3 weeks is read the story once, see what it means at face value. This is called a prima facie reading. And then go back, read it a second time, and try and unpack its more complex message. So let's read it for the first time. Are you sick of reading yet? Thank you very much. Doing great.
He sent it round to the members of his household, so that his household wife may be blessed.
Thank you. I will periodically interrupt. So one basic, this is number 1, we're reading number 1. One basic rule of thumb when studying Agadah: you must always study Agadah in context. You must always read it as part of the general sugya in which it appears. Here, the general sugya gives us the laws of Birkat HaMazon, of Zimun, of the grace after meals, and specifically the cup of wine over which Birkat HaMazon is said. And it lists 10 things that are done with this cup of wine. The 10th and final thing is that you pass it around to members of the household so that the household wife may be blessed. An interesting property of Aramaic, the phrase for his household, deveteu, doubles over as the phrase for his wife. Go on, please.
Bula was once at the house of Rav Nachman.
Thank you. By periodically, I mean I will interrupt you all the time. The story takes place in the 3rd century. And at this time, there were 2 rabbinic epicenters, one in Israel in the north and the other in Babylon. And these centers would communicate through rabbinic messengers, people who would travel back and forth and transmit the words of Torah from one to the other. Ula was an Israeli merchant, and he acted as such a rabbinic messenger. On one of his trips to Babylon, he was hosted by Rav Nachman, who we know from other stories was very hospitable. He's always hosting people. Go on, please.
They had a meal, and he said grace, and he handed the cup of benediction to Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman said to him, "Please send the cup of benediction to Yalta." He said to him, "Thus says
by Yochanan. The fruit of a woman's body is blessed only from the fruit of a man's body, since it says, he will also bless the fruit of thy body, Deuteronomy 7:13. It does not say the fruit of her body, but the fruit of thy body.
Thank you. So Birkat HaMazon is said, Rav Nachman gives his guest the honor of saying Birkat HaMazon, and after that he asks him to pass the cup to Yalta, his wife. Now, I will just mention that scholars debate whether Yalta is actually sitting at the table with them, and most of them think that she's not. Anyhow, Ula sees this as a great opportunity to give over some Israelite Torah, and he says, well, according to Rav Yochanan, we don't do that. Why don't we do that? Because the blessing in the cup, which apparently is the blessing of childbirth, of fertility, is transmitted to the woman through her husband. So it's enough that the husband drink and be blessed. Go on, please.
Meanwhile, Yalta heard, and she got up in a passion and went to the wine store and broke 400 jars of wine.
Thank you. Yalta hears this, is infuriated, goes up to the wine cellar, again, mad woman in an attic, and breaks 400 bottles of wine in a fit of rage. Go on.
Rav Nachman said to him, let the master send her another cup.
I love this. I love this moment. His wife has just broken 400 bottles of his wine, and all Rav Nachman can do is say, please just send her another cup, please. There's comedy here. This is a thoroughly whipped husband, as husbands of shrews often are. Go on, please.
He sent it to her with a message. All that wine should be counted as a benediction.
Thank you. So, Ula sends back a message saying all of this wine is counted as a blessing. Halachically, you have this in number 7. Once you say a blessing on the wine, and this is actual halacha, all of the wine in the home is blessed. So technically, there was no need to drink from that particular cup. And what Ula, in effect, is saying to Yalta is, A, you're ignorant. You don't know your halacha. And B, if you did know your halacha, you would realize you just completely overreacted. There was no call for this violent outburst. Go on. This is one of the greatest Talmudic comebacks ever. Gossip comes from peddlers and lies from rags. You can almost see the that goes after one. You know the. I tried doing this for the class and I was told I can't pull it off. But you know what I mean? Can you demonstrate? No. Oh well. This is generally interpreted as some sort of verbal attack, as if Yalta is saying, you, Ula, are a gossiping, lice-infested, rag-wearing peddler. And we know that Ula was a merchant. So thus far, the first reading. And what it does seem that we have, again, at face value, is a classic tale of a shrew. We have the Nebuch husband, we have the comedy, and we have, most importantly, an aggressive, unpleasant woman who doesn't get her own way and reacts with verbal and physical violence. But is this really the story the Talmud is telling? And it's at this point that I'd like to try and do what Adrian Rich calls revisioning. I'd like us to first to revision the story. And I'd like to begin with another act of revisioning. A rereading of the other mad woman in the attic we discussed, Bertha Mason. Jane Eyre was written in the 19th century. In the 20th century, Dominican British novelist Jean Rhys came along and said, we don't really know anything about this Bertha Mason. And no mad woman in an attic is actually born a mad woman in an attic. And so she decides to write her story. The result is a very beautiful, very sad novel called White Sargasso Sea, which is a prequel to Jane Eyre. Prequel is the opposite of sequel. It tells a story of what happened before. And it tells the story of Bertha Mason as a young girl in Jamaica, a daughter of a slave owner. After the emancipation, the natives turn on her and her family. They burn down the family home. They murder her brother. And they send her mother spiraling into madness. Look at number 8. Are you sick of reading it? Thank you.
As I knew they would be, they were waiting for me under the sandbox tree. There were two of them, a boy and a girl. They looked so harmless and quiet, no one would have noticed the glint in the boy's eyes. Then the girl grinned and began to crack the knuckles of her fingers. At each crack, I jumped and my hands began to sweat. I was holding some school books in my right hand and I shifted them to under my arm, but it was too late. There was a mark on the palm of my hand, the stain on the cover of the book. The girl began to laugh very quietly, and it was then that hate came in, and courage with the hate, so that I was able to walk past without looking at them. I knew they were following. Halfway up, they closed in on me and started talking. The girl said, "Look, the crazy girl. You're crazy like your mother. Your aunt frightened to have you in your house. She sends you for the nuns to lock up. Your mother walk about with no shoes and stockings on her feet. She tried to kill her husband, and she tried to kill you too that day you go to see her. She have eyes like zombie, and you have eyes like zombie too. You don't want to look at me, eh? I make you look at me." She pushed me, and the books I was carrying fell to the ground.
And this, says Jean Rhys, this is what drives Bertha Mason to insanity. If you treat someone as mad often enough, they will eventually become so. A similar argument is made by 20th century theorist Susie Kaplow in a very interesting essay called Getting Angry, where she discusses the gender differences between male and female anger. When men, says Kaplow, get angry, they are indignant. When women are angry, they are irrational. Now, this too becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you dismiss a woman regularly as ill-tempered, irrational, or shrewish, she will sure enough become ill-tempered, irrational, or shrewish. Look at number 9.
And the woman fears her own anger. She, the great conciliator, the steadier of rocked boats, moves out of her fear to quiet not only others' angers, but also her own. Small wonder that when the vacuum-sealed lid bursts off, the angry woman seems like a freaked-out nut. Her frenzy is intensified by the shakiness of her commitment to her own anger. What if she's really wrong? What if the other person is right? Or worse, and this is the greatest fear, hit back.
You're crazy, I don't know what you're so mad about. Exactly the response Ulla gives Yalta in our story. Ulla dismisses Yalta for being a raging shrew. But is this really what she is? Let's review the evidence. We said that Yalta appears 7 times throughout the Talmud. Let's look at some of these other mentions and see if Yalta is in fact the shrew she is accused of being. Look at number 10.
Yalta once brought some blood to Rabbi Ben
Bar-Bar-Hana. Blood is menstrual blood.
Who informed her that it was unclean. She then took it to Rabbi Isaac, the son of Rabbi Judah, who told her that it was clean. But how could he act in this manner, seeing that it was taught? If a sage declared aught unclean, another sage may not declare it clean. At first he informed her indeed that it was unclean, but when she told him that on every other occasion he declared such blood as clean, but that on the last occasion he had a pain in his eye, He gave her his ruling that it was clean.
So what do we learn about Yalta from this source? What kind of woman is she? Persistent. Manipulative. Actually, she gives a justification which is accepted by the Talmud, that it was right to ask for a second opinion in this case. Thoughtful. Good. Knowledgeable. She knows her halakha. She knows it well, and I would add, rational. That's exactly what I was going to add. Rational. She doesn't explode once she doesn't get the answer she wants. She realizes there's a problem, and she seeks a second opinion. Let's look at the second source.
Yalta said to Rav Nachman, everything that the Torah prohibited is permitted a corresponding thing. It prohibited meat.
Yeah, that should be blood. I'm not sure why the translation says meat. It's actually blood.
Blood? It prohibited blood. It permitted liver.
In other words, you're not allowed to eat blood, but you are allowed to eat liver, which tastes like blood.
The pure blood after birth, the fats of
the... Nida, in other words, you're not allowed to have relations with the woman while she's Nida, but you are allowed if she is a case of pure blood after birth.
The fats of domestic animals, the fats of wild animals, pig, marrow of the shibutim, fish, which has the same flavor.
If anybody ever wanted to know what pork tastes like, apparently it's like the marrow of a shibuta. Now go and find the shibuta.
A brother's wife, a Yevama, I would like to eat milk and meat. Rav Nachman told the cook, roast her and udder.
Right, so Yalta realizes that for everything the Torah prohibits, it actually allows something very similar. And she wants to eat milk and meat. And so Rav Nachman tells the cooks, make her an udder, because an udder is meat containing milk. What do we learn about Yalta from this source? You're whispering. Speak out. She's smart. Even very smart. She's clever. She's a systematic thinker. And again, she knows her halakha. She really does. She knows it so well, in fact, she can be a bit subversive. She knows where to look for the loopholes. Let's look at the third source.
They kept him there till the water turned to the color of blood and his flesh was covered with bright spots.
Thank you. What do we learn about... You're shaking your head. What does it mean? When the household of the exilarch, which may or may not be Yalta's household, wanted to, noise not exactly correct, to torment Rav Amram Chassid, why did they want to torment him? According to one interpretation, he was being too halachically strict. They made him lie down in the snow. Yalta hears and takes him to the bath, and she bathes him until the blood, which obviously was coming out of him, turned the water red. What do we learn about Yalta from this source? She has rachmanut. She's kind and compassionate. She's also, I would say, quite courageous, right? She's defying the household of the Resh Galuta. But most interesting, I think, is the final source, because it's remarkably similar to our own story. It's part of a larger story. Rav Nachman, at some point, has to summon Rav Yehuda, who's actually senior to him, to his court for a judicial hearing. And when Rav Yehuda comes, he sits at Rav Nachman's table, and again, like Ula, refuses to obey the rules of the household. Let's look at the last source.
Rav Nachman said to Rav Yehuda, Gonad, my daughter, will come and give us to drink. Rav Yehuda said, Shmuel said, one should not make use of a woman. Rav Nachman replied, she is a minor. Rav Yehuda said, Shmuel explicitly said, one should not make use of a woman at all, whether an adult or a minor. Rav Nachman asked him, would the master send a greeting to Yalta? Rabbi Huda replied, Shmuel said, the voice of a woman is regarded as an indecency. Rav Nachman said, through an agent? Rabbi Huda replied, Shmuel said, one should not send greetings to a woman. Rav Nachman said, through her husband? Rabbi Huda replied, Shmuel said, one should not send greetings to a woman at all. Yalta sent a message to her husband, saying, give him his verdict and let him go, lest he make you as an ignoramus.
What do we learn about Yalta from this source? Sorry? She's protective. She's concerned for her husband's honor. What else? She's smart. She does not get angry. She doesn't break anything. She doesn't shout. She is slighted here. She is refused a greeting, similar to the way Ula refuses her the cup of wine. And instead of breaking out in a temper tantrum, she tiptoes over to her husband and whispers in his ear, get rid of him, he's embarrassing you. So what do we have here? What have we seen? We've seen a woman who is knowledgeable, who is rational, who is kind, who's courageous, who's tactful, who's protective of her husband. Hardly your typical shrew. So in light of the portrait which has just emerged, and in light of what we've seen of the danger of dismissing someone's anger out of hand, I'd like to now go back and look at our story for the second time. Go back to number one. Now, to get at the true meaning of a text, and this is true of any text, but specifically of Talmudic text, we must do two things. We must go wide, we must go deep. Going wide, we just did. We looked at the context of the story, we looked at other Talmudic passages which might shed light on our own. Now we need to go deep. Going deep is doing what literary critics will call a close reading. A reading which listens closely, carefully to what is said, to what is not said, to how it is said, in an attempt to uncover the message hidden between the lines. This is what I'd like to do now. What are you waiting for?
He sends it round to the members of his household, so that his household, wife, may be blessed.
Thank you. So, one technique of close reading, if you want to know what the author intended, or what the author, him or herself, thinks of the story, you look at the way he or she has framed the story. You look at the very beginning and at the very end. So the very beginning, he sends it round to the members of his household so that his household wife may be blessed. According to the immediate preface to our story, should Ula have sent the cup round to Yalta? Yes. Good. The very end. She returned answer, gossip comes from peddlers and lies from rags. Who gets the final word in our story? She does. So we can already see that the author, in our case Chazal, seemed disposed to take Yalta's side. Let's read on.
Ula was once at the house of Rav Nachman. They had a meal, and he said, great. And he handed the cup of benediction to Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman said to him, please send the cup of benediction to Yalta. He said to him, thus said Reb Yohanan, the fruit of a woman's body is blessed only from the fruit of a man's body, since it says, he will also bless the fruit of thy body. It does not say the fruit of her body, but the fruit of thy body.
Thank you. I'd like to try and understand Ula's argument here. I don't think we can just write it off as some chauvinistic attempt to exclude women, because it's actually based on some very serious old world biology. Look at number 11, Aristotle. Aristotle was not only one of the most important philosophers of the ancient world, he was also one of the most important biologists. And this is what he says.
semen possessing the principle of the form. Female is that which receives the semen, but is unable to cause semen to take shape or to discharge it.
Thank you. So according to biological theories of antiquity, a woman was a receptacle, a vessel, holding the man's seed. Under the basis of which, says Ulla, if a woman is there to merely hold her husband's seed, she doesn't need to be blessed. She will receive the blessing through that seed. And again, it's enough that the man be blessed. Let's read on, please. Back to our story.
Meanwhile, Yalta heard, and she got up in a passion and went to the wine store and broke 400 jars of wine.
Thank you. I'd like to claim that this is no temper tantrum. This is no temper tantrum. This isn't Yalta breaking bottles in a fit of jealous rage. If I'm not going to drink the wine, nobody's going to drink the wine. This is actually a very clever, very subtle response to Ulla's argument. I'm a vessel, am I? That's all women are. Okay, let's see how you do without vessels. I'm not going to touch the wine. I'm just going to deconstruct the vessels. If vessels are that unimportant, it shouldn't really matter, should it? Let's read on.
Rabbi Nachman said to him, "Let the master send her another cup." He sent it to her with a message. All that wine could be counted as a benediction.
Thank you. Again, I'm going to claim there's some serious subtext here. This is not Ulla really making a halachic argument that all the wine is technically blessed and you don't really need to drink from this particular cup. Because if he really believed that, he would have said that the first time Rav Nachman would have asked him to send the cup. Ulla understands very well what Yalta has just tried to tell him. And he answers her in kind. Let's just think of the symbolism here. What is the cup, the vessel? The woman. Good, the woman's womb. What is the wine? The seed, the man's seed. By saying all the wine is blessed and you don't need this cup, Ulla is in effect saying women are unimportant. The vessel doesn't matter. It's interchangeable. It's insignificant. The only thing that's important is what is inside the vessel, i.e. man's seed. And women are inessential to the procreative process. Last line.
She returned answer. Gossip comes from peddlers and life from rags.
Thank you. Now, scholars don't really know what to do with this final line. It's very strange. It doesn't make much sense. Some basically say she's throwing at him however many insults she can. It has been claimed that she's actually quoting from another ancient text, the Book of Ben Sira. I want to claim the following. Yes.
So I was just going to say, this is very factual, though. Peddlers did spread gossip from.
That's true. That's true. The Hebrew word for gossip comes from the word for peddler.
Rags certainly can
carry. Right. No, no, no. She's certainly saying something factual. The question is why? Why is she telling Ulla this? Yes. That's interesting. The gender reversal claim is actually made with regards to this line. I would like to claim that, yes?
The statement that life comes from rags.
Yeah.
It's a statement, it doesn't mean that the rags contain life in it. It's a reference to spontaneous generation.
Very good. Very good. Just for that.
I think the rag.
Very good. Very, very good. Very nice.
It's the rag itself that gives rise to life.
So thank you, because I always thought that this was going on, but I haven't seen this anywhere else, so thank you for validating me here. According, again, to ancient biology, and you have this in number 12, lice spontaneously generate. They are born out of the air. And what I'm going to claim that Yata is saying here is lice and gossip, for that, you don't need a female. But to create anything else, anything more meaningful, a woman is necessary, and yes, women are essential to the procreative process. Now, I'd like to take a moment here and consider Yata's strategy, because it's important. Yes?
I just wondered if you'd also add a literary motif to this. It begins by talking about spreading blessing from one person to the other with a cup of wine, and it ends with the idea of Lashon Hara and Ricky Luke, which starts to spread around.
That's very interesting, but what would you make of that connection? That's nice. That's nice. I'd have to think and see if we can actually, you know, extract meaning from that. Oh, it should always make a point. But I'm going to think about that one. Thank you. Let's look at Yata's strategy. Yata does not at any point say, I am not a vessel. The dominant biological tradition of her time viewed women as vessels, and Yata accepts that. But within that tradition, she tries to carve out a space for herself. As such, Yata is the ideal reader, and it's her strategy that I would like to adopt for our series. We will, over the next few weeks, encounter certain textual traditions which we might find jarring, which we might find clash with our progressive 21st century sensibilities. And the point is not to reject these traditions, but like Yata, to try and find a space for ourselves within them. That's what we did tonight. We took a text which seemed at first reading to be misogynistic, and we saw that through a close, careful, contextual reading, it was actually a lot closer to our contemporary worldview than we initially thought. Now, I'd like to say one more thing, and then perhaps we'll open for a few minutes of questions, and then we will end. If you leave here tonight with anything, I'd like for it to not be the laws of the grace after meals, or the literary tradition of shrews, or whether women are in fact vessels and what that means. If you leave with anything, I'd like for it to be this. Ulla dismisses women as insignificant part of the procreative process. Generations of readers have dismissed Yalta for being a raging shrew. But as we've seen, dismissal is the worst kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Katharina, in number 5 we saw, says, "If I be waspish, best beware my sting. If you treat me like a snarling, scratching, biting shrew, I will be that snarling, scratching, biting shrew." Shylock, another famous Shakespearean other, says in number 13, "Thou callest me dog before thou hadst a course, but since I am a dog, beware my fangs. Treat me like a heartless, diabolical monster, I will become that heartless, diabolical monster, and I will demand my pound of flesh." We saw how Bertha Mason was mocked repeatedly for being crazy until she is in fact driven mad. And in number 14, which we won't read, Rav Kook discusses the Talmudic passage about Timna, who wanted to convert and join the Jewish people, and the patriarchs dismissed her as unworthy. And so Timna goes off and gives birth to Amalek. Dismiss someone as mad or wicked or unworthy, and they will, sure enough, become the thing you dismiss them for. And we saw how men will sometimes do this to women, but adults do it to children all of the time. We do it to people whose culture we don't understand. We do it to anybody who doesn't see things the way that we do. And so next time you find yourself about to dismiss someone, and we all do, pause and think of Yalta and think of how unfairly she was dismissed and give that other person a hearing. You may not end up agreeing with them, but at least you won't have created another madwoman in an attic. Good night. We have a few moments for questions if anybody wants to ask, protest, disagree passionately. Yes? Yes, yes, he does. From these passages and from others, he is very careful of her honor. Absolutely. Anything else? Okay, next week, Choma, the femme fatale. Good night.
Is anybody driving to the Gush area so my friend doesn't have to come pick me up? No, nobody's going to Gush? Okay, thanks.